Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Recorded live in California, USA, it's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. The show that loves big, likes pop, has fun. Now from the Wilson World Studios, here's Tom.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Big Pop Fun, another episode of fun. I'm Tom Wilson. I'm your lovely and questionably talented host, bringing you another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we whip our horses into a frenzy. But we realize that our horses really shouldn't be whipped into a frenzy because we're in traffic, because I live in Los Angeles, and horses, if you're on a sleigh here, trust me on this, you're not going very fast, because there are a lot of other magical sleighs out there who are trying to get places also. I just got back. I was on the road. And I was literally on the road. I drove to Escondido, California to pick up my guitar. My guitar got a very significant crack in the top, thanks to the wonderful agents of the TSA and the airlines. Anyway, they open all your stuff, as we know. Hey, they open your stuff. They take it out. They mess with it. Somebody played tequila, I think, on my guitar, took it out of tune, put a nice crack in it, putting it back in the case, and I had to get it repaired. You know, years back, I used to like it better when a guy seemed like an expert. I don't think you see that a lot anymore. And I know I'm beginning the phase of my life where I'm going, you know what was good? That's not good today. But having a repair person to be able to look at something and kind of put on thick glasses and pay attention to it, I think that just felt a little better than going to than bringing your screen back to Best Buy and having Billy, the name tag kid, just go, well, did you put the HDMI cable in it? What did you do? Did you reboot? Did you reboot? Rick, he didn't reboot it. He brought it back. You know, that doesn't feel as good as like a television repairman. I know they don't exist anymore. I'm not trying to bring them back, but it felt pretty good when you brought it to a guy who put on thick glasses and just said, well, let me look at this thing. And you thought, oh, I guess he must know what he's talking about. He's an expert at this. My television is in good hands. And it just felt good because he was, oh, look at this wire here. Well, that's not right. Have you? Okay, well, plug it in. Let's try it now. Oh, it's coming in. Let me turn some dials. And then, you know, he would turn the dials and it would work. And you would take it home. You didn't just, you know, well, this one's faulty. Throw it out, buy a new one. But it's very difficult to find guitar repair people who have that attitude anymore, especially with acoustic guitars. And acoustic guitars are very popular now. Mumford & Sons, all the Lumineers, everybody of Monsters and Men, everyone's playing acoustic guitars, but don't try to really get a nice one fixed because they just don't. Yeah, they're not out there. Yes, I like going to the Guitar Center myself because it has the wall of electric guitars and it's got kids all trying to play, you know, Smoke on the Water all at the same time in different time signatures. But don't bring an acoustic guitar and say, hey, do you know any repair people? Because the same, you know, Best Buy dudes working guitar saying, hey, Rick, do we fix these ones that are with a wood box with the wires on it? It's an acoustic guitar, yeah. So don't go there. But I found Chris Camp, wonderful guy, down in Escondido, California, which is far in traffic from my house. That's the point I was getting to. But I brought the guitar there, and you know what he did? Yeah. Put on glasses and said, well, let's take a look at this thing. And put it up on a table, under a light. It looked like he was performing surgery on it. I felt like, you know, I felt like giving the guitar a kiss before leaving it and just saying, hey, everything's going to be fine, guitar. But he took wonderful care of my guitar, and through hours of traffic, I have returned with a repaired and wonderful acoustic guitar to keep doing my shows, my special brand of frolic and fun across this great land of ours. I'm not sure. Hey, could I say just welcome to the podcast and do my two commercials? My one commercial is support artists wherever you are. Support the arts by buying art. Buy a ticket to a show. Buy a CD. I know your CD player's all rusted now and you have an iPod and everything, but when the guy is there with a CD or a girl and their song, buy their CD. Help a brother or sister out. Go to a show, buy something from a painter. As I said, look on eBay. There are many painters who are selling tiny jewels that you'll have in your house for the rest of your life. You'll get so much satisfaction from it. So support artists everywhere and support this artist by buying my book, The Masked Man, available on Nook, Kindle, iPad, every kind of thing. People have liked it a lot. I've been very gratified with the response, and people are still reading it. So I hope you read it. I hope you enjoy it. I did not write a book, however, about my experience meeting Kevin Michael Richardson. I don't know. Did I play the guitar in that show? Maybe I did. We were in a play together called Class, maybe 20 or so years ago. And I'll tell you, I have the play Class in my memory is really noteworthy because I have not remembered less about a play that I've ever been in. I don't know what it was about. I don't know what I did in it. I remember having fun with Kevin and a few actors and going to this theater and doing it. The audience seemed to like it. But it wasn't, it wasn't that memorable a piece. But you're an actor and you're just taking jobs and you say, hey, you're doing a play over there? Sure, I'll be in the play. Let's do it. And I met Kevin Michael Richardson, who at that time was a young actor just on his way. Kevin has gone on really to become one of the premier voiceover talents in the entire industry, not only animation, but announcing as well. All of that, all of the deep guy voice thing he's got. Boy, he's got quite a voice. And people who listen to the podcast say, boy, Tom, I like your voice and everything, which is, I thank you very much for that. But the fact is, there are guys who have an octave lower than I do and significantly larger resonators in their chest, their head, their neck. So it's Richard Rumbles with the James Earl Jones thing that I don't think I have really. But anyway, I really enjoyed talking with him. I'm glad to have my guitar back. I hope I see you in a show sometime. And I hope, hey, have fun with my conversation with my old buddy, Kevin Michael Richardson.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Kevin Michael Richardson is our guest. Thanks, Kev, for being here.
Thank you, Tommy. Thanks for asking.
Is it officially like Kevin Michael Richardson? Was that a SAG thing?
Just business. Yeah, SAG and AFTRA, because there's like two other Kevin Richardsons in the union. There's a Kevin Richardson and the Backstreet Boys. I'm not him.
Really?
And there's a Kevin Richardson.
Because that's why you're here.
Yeah.
I thought, okay.
I mean,
thanks
yeah,
a lot
no,
for
no,
coming,
no, that's
Kev.
Me. Wait. No, that's me. Bye. There's another Kevin Richardson, who's also an African-American actor who I look nothing like. If we stood by each other, it would look like a before and after commercial for like Nutrisystem or something. This guy's like a stick. And there's, I think, another one. And I was told that in 1989 or 90 when I was trying to get in the union. And they were like, oh, well, sir, that name is taken. I go, well, that's my name. And they're like, well, you know.
Too bad.
And I use my middle name.
Sure.
So I almost changed it, though, to another name completely.
To completely another name. Yeah.
I was thinking of Victor Stone from
Victor Stone is good.
Yeah. I was thinking Vic Stone.
Get Victor Stone.
Yeah. From DC Comics. He was Cyborg. And I said, Vic Stone. That's what, but I, after a while, I was
Vic thinking, Stone would be a good like, one-hour cop show.
Yeah, yeah.
Vic Stone.
Vic Stone, right?
He's on. Yeah.
But, nah. So I stayed with
Did you grow up here in L.A.?
I lived here for like 22 years.
Yeah, where were you born?
I was born in the Bronx, and I was raised in Mount Vernon, New York, which is in Westchester County, which is on the borderline of the Bronx and Westchester County. Mount Vernon,
uh-huh,
New York is literally on the border. I'm literally 40 feet away from the Bronx, my home, my house that I grew up in. Literally. Literally. I'm on the borderline.
You measured it?
Yeah, well, no. Yeah. From eye distance, from the parked car across the street to our car, yeah I would say it's about 30, 40 feet. Yeah.
Were you a normal kid or were you into cartoons and stuff? Were you into all this stuff?
No, I was definitely not normal. I don't know.
What's the matter with you?
I was strange. I was weird, man. I was.
Both mom and dad were there when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were there and the rest of my siblings.
Mom's a housewife? Did she work or something?
No, she worked, actually.
What did mom do?
She was a nurse. My mom was a nurse.
Really?
And my dad
at a doctor's office or a hospital or
like hospice. private nurse. Hospice yeah, she worked. Nurse. At, yeah, she first. I think originally was for hospice. Then became hospice after that for like the rest of her, you know, years before she retired.
That's a long time in hospice. Huh?
Oh yeah. She
How
did, it for
she,
quite a,
did she?
Quite a while.
And she, but she dealt with it okay. I mean, she made peace with kind of what she did.
Or? Yeah, and they loved her. I remember all her patients loved her. I remember that her patients would call to, you know, say hi to me because she would talk about me, and I'm this little kid talking yeah. to them, you know. You know, to these really sweet people.
That well, that's were, a, I mean, it's a wonderful thing. I mean, done yeah. in a beautiful way. Being yeah. a hospice nurse is something.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And my mom is just.
Or did she come back and, like, you know, start sweetie. Smacking you in the head? She was, she was Jekyll and Hyde. She goes back. No, she was all peaceful.
Yeah, she was.
She put you to bed at night. Now go to the light, Kevin. No. Go toward the light.
No, no, mama's really sweet, you know, and I wish her happy Mother's Day coming up for this Sunday. I wish all the mothers out there happy Mother's Day.
Yeah.
Your mom.
Yeah, so, my mom's back there in Pennsylvania. Mother's Day.
Yeah, so, yeah, see, my family's from Jamaica, born and raised in Jamaica, West Indies.
Mom and dad both.
My whole family, siblings, everybody. But when they moved to the United States, I was conceived here. So and born here. So
and when so they came here right before you were born.
Yeah,
right
yeah, before yeah, I was conceived in here in New York. Yeah.
What did Dad do?
Dad at the time. Dad was it's like talk about the Jamaican, you know, jokes about them having like 100 job. I have 200 job. My father was he owned a dry cleaners. He moved and he had a limo business and he stayed in the limo business for a while and then went into real estate. So he was kind of a jack of all trades.
What I mean, what did he do in Jamaica in order to come here? Do you
Dentistry.
Know what I mean?
My dad was he worked like as a dental assistant. You know,
in Jamaica.
Like, yeah, and he came out here and he also designed dentures and stuff like that for people. And stuff. So my father literally is like a jack of kind of all trades.
Really? Is dad alive?
Yeah, Pop's still alive. They're both up there. They're both up there, but they're still here.
Because I'm always impressed by that. But by every culture from everywhere, the amount of work and sort of ingenuity it takes to go, I'm going to save my money.
Yeah.
We're going to near the Bronx, New York,
and
I'm just going to have to figure it out. Man.
I'm just going to figure it out
how to make some money.
I don't know how we did it because originally when he moved to the Bronx, they moved – we were in all of us were in like this two-bedroom apartment and we didn't make a lot of dough.
Sure.
Parents, you know, mom and dad didn't make a lot of dough back then. And we moved to Mount Vernon in like 72, around there, you know, 72, 73. And then
wow.
I stayed there. Then I moved out here to L.A. I moved out here in L.A. in 91.
But you said you were kind of a weird kid. What was that about?
Oh, dude. Yeah, it was just.
Were you just trouble or what?
No, I was the class clown.
Oh, were
I was
you?
That and, you know, going to my sister. I had a brother and sister in the same school. I think I was in first grade while they were in seventh and eighth. And I would sneak out of class telling the teacher I needed to go to the bathroom to go to their class and tell jokes to their, you know, teacher
and
classroom.
To put on a little show.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, this is the meatball show. It made no sense. I'm like, meatballs up my nose. Kids were laughing.
So the older kids are just laughing at you, but you think it's a show. You think you're in showbiz.
And my brother's like shaking his head with his head in his hands. It's my sister too. And the teachers I remember didn't quite know how to tell me to get out.
Kevin, I mean, where do you think that is from? You know, where's that from? I mean, was that in you like when you were a little kid? You just getting up on tables doing shows?
Yeah, it was weird. Yeah, I think, let me see. I remember watching like Andy Griffith or Flip Wilson was a big influence too. And I'd watch them and watch those shows and come to the dinner table or breakfast table and start imitating their voice.
Doing Geraldine?
Yeah, Geraldine.
Sure.
And, I kill him! You know, that
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
thing. And then, Barney Fife and all that stuff like that. But Sesame Street had a little bit of an impact on my childhood, even though it almost traumatized me. Because my father, you know, my very strict dad would always say, you have to learn the ABC. Come, sit in front of the TV and watch the show. And then, you know, James Earl Jones would like either say ABC. He was very young, you know, and he would be on the TV and he would count. And, you know, and here I am 3-4 feet in front of the TV and he'd, you know, they'd do this close-up of him. Do you remember this? James Earl Jones, they'd do a close-up of him on Sesame Street and he'd go, 1, 2, 3, and I'd be like, start crying.
Number man is scary.
Yeah, I was just like, and my father's like, watch the TV. And I'm like, you know, I was like traumatized by this, you know, this big bald headed brother, like with his teeth, you know, and 4, 5, you know, be like, you know, I was like shaking. It was kind of eerie back then. And they had another bit called, na 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 beep beep beep. Do you remember that one?
With the puppet. Yeah, sure, yeah, with the puppets.
And that was my – that's what I stole for my talent show at like 5, 6 years old for a school talent show in a great school. And I and that was definitely the bug at the time.
Na-na-ma-na.
Yeah. Yeah, they go, and here we have here Kevin Richardson. And I go up there. No music, nobody else. I just take the mic and go, na-na-na-na. Beep, 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 beep. No, 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 no.
And you, that's what you, that was your talent.
No, no, no. Long pause, just sit there. No, 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 no. I did the whole bit from the show. And then they laughed, they clapped, and I started to get no, 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 no. And I went on for like 15 minutes, and they had to pull me off the stage. Yeah,
so you were a weird kid from the very beginning.
I was a weird kid.
In high school, did you start doing shows? Were you an athlete when you were?
Yeah, I was a shot putter. And my first putter. Yeah, I threw shot putter in my first high school.
Was that your like the first time you were an athlete? Was like, what should I do? Football? No,
that's a almost
shot putter.
I wanted to. Yeah, and I said I kind of like the shot putter. And I was an okay shot putter. I was all right. I wasn't the best, you know. Some guys said you were pretty good, but I was.
What talents does it take to be a shot putter? Because
I remember I was pretty strong, and I would do weird things. Like, I would lift up the back of cars back then, the back of small cars like Toyotas and stuff, and, like, show off and, you know, with my buddies. And not drunk or anything. It was just something to do.
Yeah.
And even buddies mine today that I went to Syracuse with would remind me, hey, you remember when you did that? Go, yeah. But I did it back then, and the teachers were like, all right, we need to do something with this. All right, you need to channel it somewhere. So I ended up throwing –
Shot put.
Yeah. And I took it seriously at the time. I was into it. I was really into it. Then, of course, I ended up switching schools and went to a boarding high school in Pennsylvania for 3 years. With a very strict school.
Mom and Dad send you to Pennsylvania?
The class clown syndrome got a little too heavy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they said we need to straighten you out?
Yeah, the teachers were getting a little tired of it. So this school was basically whipped my ass into shape, man. It was pretty hardcore. It was pretty heavy duty.
What school was this called?
St. Francis Prep in Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, they closed down in, I think, 89.
Huh.
And I got out of there in 82, and it was one of the best experiences of my life. I mean, it was strict. You know, those guys, you know, Franciscan faculty. You know,
right.
They wore the black robes and the white ropes around them, and they didn't take any shit, man. They were hardcore.
Yeah, in the spirit of St. Francis himself.
Yeah, go figure.
Yeah, exactly.
What would St. Francis do? Come, Kevin. He loved animals. Here, go into this den of lions.
They really were – some of these guys are so great. A couple of them passed on. They were just really sweet souls. And
so you had a good experience there.
They really did. I hated it for the first couple months, man. You had to wear, like, jacket and tie every day. You had class every day except Sunday, you know, and study hall every night. Except Saturday. And it was just a weird adjustment for me at the time, but it was a great experience. 125 kids the entire high school. But they were from everywhere. They were from China, Japan, Colombia, you know, Venezuela, you know, Iran. There was one student from Iraq. It was like this melting pot of international students. And you got along with everyone, and it was just – it was really, really something, man. I really ended up loving it after that.
Were you in plays and things like that?
Yeah,
always
did plays, always did shows, always did like some type of theater. I was also in the Glee Club. I didn't join their basketball team. They didn't have a football team. They didn't have a shot put team. You know, they had track and field. I wasn't a fast runner, but it was Glee Club and drama
from the shot putter.
Yeah. It's like,
is something wrong with that? Yes, I'm big and I'm in shape, but is something wrong with singing?
But. Yeah. It wasn't that bad, but I had fun, man. I just knew that I had the – I always knew that I wanted to work in entertainment since I was a kid. I just knew from an early age. That's what I wanted to do.
And did you go off to college after that, or did you go into show business?
Syracuse. I went to Syracuse.
Syracuse University.
Yeah. It was. That was a party school.
Syracuse?
Oh, my God. It was a party school. With all that snow and cold, you got
to
do something.
Not a lot to do in Syracuse.
Not a lot. Not too much, but the campus was just – it was just one big party.
What were you studying there?
Theater.
Oh, okay.
I studied theater. Minored in psych and English, but I knew theater was my thing. Not musical theater. I just did straight theater and just took off from there.
What kind of plays were you in Syracuse?
Ooh, I did Shakespeare, you know, William Congreve, Restoration periods, and then I did like a couple of contemporary things. One last thing I think was called How the Other Half Loves, which was a play we did on the main stage too. I was invited to you know, joined the, they had a regional theater as well as the student production theater. Mm-hmm. In the regional theater, the artistic director, who was also the chairman of our drama department, who recently passed away, Arthur Storch, great man. You could see him in Exorcist, the movie The Exorcist with Linda Blair. He gets his nuts grabbed when he's like trying to
handle it. He's great in that. He was great.
Given him shit once, but he was a fantastic teacher, and he was very strict. And he was kind enough to ask me back. He showed confidence to ask me back in two of their main stage productions as a student, and I'll never forget that. And that showed me, developed a little self esteem in myself to realize that I could really pursue this.
Yeah, because you're a physically large guy, and I tell you that as a physically large guy myself.
Right.
Were they casting you in ways that were interesting casting, or did you end up whatever that strong stage presence that with a big voice and a commanding thing when you come on stage, people just go, oh, a man has just entered the stage. Was it those kinds of things?
It was like 50-50. Really, it was like I got casted. I was cast as a king, you know, or a duke, for Shakespeare stuff, or even as a cousin in Romeo and Juliet. I was Benvolio, you know, which was no specific, you know, size at all. You know,
well, that's great,
right? You know, and How the Other Half Loves. That was Alan Ayckbourn, I believe, who wrote that. That was really a simple-minded, like, employee for this, like, big businessman. And there was no size or anything involved. Actually, he was supposed to be this meek guy. And I was always somewhat of a big fellow. And I had a lot of fun playing that role, you know. So I didn't really let the size factor bother me personally.
Oh, of course. You know,
there'd be a couple of reviews where, you know, he was rather large in the role, you know. Uh-huh. But they enjoyed it. You know, I remember some people say, you know, making comments, you know, this big guy, but they were fine with it, you know. Mm-hmm. But it never really bothered me, you know. And I never liked reading reviews during a show anyway. I always waited until the reviews were over.
Right.
Until the play was over.
Yeah, yeah.
Until I started reading the reviews.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it always, you know, it affects you sometimes if you let it, you know. If one review guy says, well, .. you know, he should have been more like this. And subconsciously, while you're doing the show, you could be paying attention to that review and letting it affect you, which can alter your entire performance. And that's not the whole process of, you know, how you got to get to the main, you know, performance in the first place during the rehearsal. You know, and some guys do that. And I see it, you know, I see them trying to change stuff. And I'm like, you know, don't read them until it's done.
Well, really, they don't know what they're talking about anyway.
That's right.
Really. They've never been in a play.
Right.
They've never really done anything.
Yeah.
Now, because of most of them, their newspapers are going out of business anyway.
It's sad.
So they don't know what they're talking about. So we should have never listened to a thing they said anyway.
That's right. You're right. Well said, my friend.
I remember I was a teenager and I was I was doing plays and all that. I was in theater.
Where'd you go?
I moved west. I'm from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But I went to Arizona State University.
Wow.
Because I was so sick. All the doctors said, you go to Phoenix. You go to the clean air.
Really?
Of Arizona.
Wow.
In order to feel better. So I went far.
Did
but
it
unlike
work?
You, I felt Not to the degree that I would have hoped it would.
Yeah.
It didn't work great. But
that's a big jump.
That was a very, very big jump and a big culture shock.
Oh my goodness!
And everything. But I moved
Philly. I went
west pretty early.
All that cheesesteak, he sacrificed a lot there.
I did sacrifice a lot.
Are they good as I hear they are? I hear they're fantastic.
Oh, they're fantastic.
They are. Never had a real official Philly cheesesteak. The only time I was in Philly really is when we stopped in the Philadelphia 30th Street Station.
Sure.
You know, as a pit stop for when we had to get to school in Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh. Of course.
But we never really got to explore the town. So.
Well, 30th Street, it's a beautiful train station.
That was nice. It was beautiful.
Old-time train station.
I haven't been there since.
Well,
wow, dude, I had no idea. Philly.
Oh yeah, I'm a Philly guy. When at the end of that, did you continue in the theater after Syracuse, or when, you know, was big time showbiz for money calling, or did you get jobs? You know, you went into a theater company, or you went that route.
No, I ended up, you know, I was lucky to find an agent in New York to do like commercials and stuff like that, and. got involved with a little, sort of like a community off-Broadway production called, The Revelers, Christmas Revelers or something like that. It was like a Christmas mini production, which was fun. But I was invited, so really not too much theater. It was more so film or a guest spot here and there. But I was asked to come out to do a play here in 91 from a class, classmates of mine, George Mazurlis and Sam Lloyd. They played a couple of the singing background guys on Scrubs.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam Lloyd and his uncle Christopher Lloyd asked me to do this play at the Tiffany Theater called Musical Comedy Murders of 1940.
Is this the Chris that I know, or is this the producer, Christopher Lloyd?
Christopher Lloyd, the actor and producer. He's an actor and producer.
Oh, okay.
He produced this play with his nephew, Chris Lloyd from Taxi.
Yeah.
Yes,
that I know.
That's right. Oh, my God.
Right. I know Chris Lloyd.
I never put that together.
Yeah.
Holy
Chris Lloyd, my friend.
That's right. Yeah, Chris. That's
because
right.
There is a Christopher Lloyd who's also a television producer.
How could I not put that together?
No, I thought you meant him.
Hello.
You meant my
You could do it to me.
No, it's all right. Now I don't knock anyone in the head anymore.
Butthead.
I just punch them right in the face.
I might fancy that.
Well, yeah, but people don't know. Chris's great dedication to theater
and has
done wonderful plays around the country for the past, 30 or 40 years.
I believe, yes.
So they contacted you to come out here and do a play.
To come out here and do a play. And I did it. And I was planning on just staying for that summer of 91. And I stayed ever since.
You just stayed here?
Yeah, I stayed ever since, yeah. I was planning literally just coming here, doing the show, going back home, my folks, and I just stayed.
What was Chris Lloyd like in a play when
he
came out here?
He was one of the producers, so he was not in the play.
Oh, he wasn't? Yeah, he was just producing it?
No, he was just producing it with his nephew and George Mazurlis.
Wow,
and
what year was this?
91, summer of 91, yeah.
Wow.
Summer of 91, so it was like, May, June, July, yeah, and I think we opened in July, yeah.
Did you enjoy the experience?
Oh, it was fun. Yeah. It was fun. It was a blast.
And what did you – how did you get involved? How did this become predominantly a voiceover career for you?
Man, that's – I got to tell you, because I knew that I wanted to do on camera. I knew I wanted to do TV and stuff like that. And film came along. Yeah, sure. I did a little few sprinkling of that, And I found out that my agency here, CED at the time, which is now CESD.
Well, I should thank them. We are in their offices right now.
Yes.
CESD. A fabulous talent agency here
Lobster
in Los
bin,
Angeles.
Steaks right behind
you. Yes, exactly. Boy, they're very nice. I didn't expect the massage as we're doing it, but really, they go all out at CESD.
Yeah, they're grateful. I'm happy here. I've been with them in New York, and as soon as I came out here, I became an affiliate here. So I've been with them over, 24 years.
Well, this is a very big, major agency, especially in commercials and voiceover.
And I had no idea. I was just happy with who I was with. They were so kind that I didn't know about other agencies. I just stayed with them, because
so they were your agent, and you just start to go out for voiceover? You talk to them?
I nagged them. Because I found out that people were making a living doing this. And I was like, what? I said, are you serious? I said, wait, just send me out. I had no idea that, I didn't put that together that, these cartoons and these commercials and these movie trailers and these, industrials that people were narrating it were getting paid, and some considerably well. And I said, I could do this. I nagged the agency once I found out that they represented people who did this. And I said, I could do this. And they said, well, it's very tough, dear. You can't. It's a small circle of people you can't get in this business.
In the voiceover world.
Yeah, and I was like, in my head, I was like, that was like Mandarin Chinese to me. I didn't understand. I was like, well, no, just send me out. That's all I would say for like a period of 8 to 9 months until they finally sent me out. And I was called back on the first thing I was sent out on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess they changed their tune and things got a little serious and it started snowballing from there.
I'll get back to that. Can I ask you, we did a play together. We did
We did that
class.
Right after I did
Right after you did the Chris Lloyd play, then you came on and did a play with me.
That was in 91.
Was that 91?
Wait, 91, 92? That was 91, 92.
I know we did it, and I'm thinking, I'm talking to Kevin today, so I'm thinking we have to talk about that play. And Kevin, I remember the name of it, and I guess it was relatively forgettable because I don't remember the theater or the director.
Tracy Tracy on
the lady, blonde lady.
It was an old lady. It was on Robertson. It was on Robertson.
Oh, Robertson
Tracy
Theater.
Roberts. Tracy. No.
Yeah. It was Tracy. Anyway, we were in a play together. And that's where we met.
Yeah, that's where we met. Yeah,
apparently,
yeah.
Carolyn Barry,
who was also a client here at CESD. So I haven't seen her, man. Literally, I haven't seen her in like, I don't know how many years.
I think the play killed her.
Yeah.
I mean, her career. I don't mean her personally. You know, I just mean her career. I mean, she was finished. I mean, working with you and I in apparently as forgettable play as has ever been.
I look back. And another buddy of mine was in that, Rob Donovan.
Uh-huh. Jeff Harlan was in it.
Carolyn
had contacted me.
But as Peggy Farrisee, I think, as you know,
Kevin, I mean, you're in that at that time of your career, and somebody just goes, hey, you want to do this thing in this theater? And you just go, okay.
Yeah, they were excited. They just said, do some impersonations. Do this, do that, do that. And they were like, okay. And they called me, you're in. And I was like, what? And I was excited. And then when I saw you, I was like, oh, wow, I got Tom. I was very excited, man. I was like a little bitch.
Well, we had fun doing the play, though I don't remember a thing about it. I remember having fun with you.
It was bizarre.
Can I go back? Let me go back, 30 years now. But I am curious, how does a kid from 40 feet from the Bronx come out with such a classic diction the theater? Is that from theatrical training at Syracuse University, or were mom and dad very concentrated on you speaking in a certain way?
No, not at all. They were my folks. No, not at all.
Because 40 feet from the Bronx, you would think a little something.
Well, my buddies, when I go back and visit, and I see a couple of my friends back there, whether it be Italian or Black or Puerto Rican. You know, we always be like, "Hey, what's up, man?" You know, we like hang out.
Yeah,
you just get into that groove or the rhythm
of
how he speaks, but. Not consciously, I think. It just comes out, you know. But at the same time, generally, I always did sound like this, I think. Because even sometimes they would make fun of me until they razzed me to the point where I was like talking like, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
But I think maybe television had a lot to do with it, you know, And
you mean watching TV?
Watching a lot of television stuff and getting involved in theater. You know, because most stage shows, everyone used a stage standard or British received.
Of course.
You know, dialect. But, you know, that's the only thing I can really do.
But I think for a lot of people, I think that dialects generally are kind of being washed out. I mean, they're still there to a certain extent, but people have more of a relationship with their television than the people in their family or anyone they're speaking to, I think, on the street.
Yeah,
it's almost all becoming kind of televisionized.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. I sure did, definitely.
Yeah.
In my case, because I was the odd bird in my family.
So you start doing – I'm sorry, but fast forward, back to this stuff. Have you always been doing plays as well as the stuff that would be, you know, quote-unquote for money, the voiceover stuff or whatever? Or was there a time when you said, well, look – I've done a lot of theater. Yeah. I have plenty on my resume. And just, you know, being out every night at all hours and making nothing, you know, I'm about done with that.
Yeah. I mean, it basically stopped almost, I think, immediately after I did that.
Don't put that on me, Richardson.
No, no.
Don't put it on me. Carolyn Barry already did.
No.
Okay. She blames me for destroying her theatrical
career.
She
asked me to do another play, too, where I was a black angel for a Jewish family. I can't remember what theater it was, and she helped write it, and there was some music, and I had to do a little singing, and that was it. It was like almost immediately after I last saw you I was pretty much done, and because on camera was happening, you know, and then voiceover was starting.
Well, before we move to voiceover, what's your favorite play? Your favorite, you know, the favorite on stage experience that you had that really kind of put it all together.
How the Other Half Loves.
And where was that?
That was done at Syracuse Stage when we did that at Alan Ayckbourn. And the Lincoln Center came and filmed it and put it in their archives.
Really?
They were so happy with it. So you could actually view it. and at the Lincoln Archives.
Wow, that's great.
And it was a fun experience for me. It was one of my first professional experiences. And
really? The Lincoln Center has a library of performing arts,
yes,
which is right there at, what, 66th and about Broadway.
So bad. I'm the worst New Yorker. I was like, yeah, it's right there, right around the corner.
Well, you know,
I'm so bad.
You go to the Metropolitan Opera House, and you make a little right, and there's a little walkway in there, and you get back in there, right next to the Vivian Beaumont Theater.
That sounds right. That sounds right.
Actually. I know, Don't mess with me, Richardson.
You're from Philly, didn't that? This is embarrassing.
No, but I used to go there all the time. I used to practically live there because my room there in New York was such a hovel.
The price was ridiculous, wasn't it?
It was incredible.
Isn't that crazy?
I was really starving to death. So you could go to the Library of Performing Arts, and you could listen to albums, albums,
old shows, and stuff
blues
like that.
Performers, and all that kind of stuff. They had comfortable chairs.
Yeah,
you could read
a little
book.
Cubicle too that you exactly. watch it right. Yeah.
Exactly.
I didn't know that.
And then outside there was that big sculpture, reclining nude sculpture in a reflecting pool. I spent a lot of time there. So I remember the Library of Performing Arts, where now
impressive
Kevin's performance
in
How the Other Half Loves.
which was kind of an honor. That was very cool.
Yeah, that's
very
great.
Cool. And then I watched it. I took my wife back there when we went to visit family and just watched it. And I was like, oh, my God. It was like 40 pounds ago, 50 pounds ago for me. And then I had hair and she laughed. And it was a fun show. It was very fun. And watching it reminded me of how much fun we had. The reviews were great on it.
Yeah. But you went on, from the play that we were in, you went on and really established yourself in the voiceover world.
Well,
from those auditions. I mean, I hadn't seen you for a while, but I had heard that you were doing it, or I heard that you were at this session, or that, oh, Kevin. And then I saw you, and it was clear that things were going pretty darn well in voiceover.
I'm happy. I'm definitely happy. I had no idea that it'd be
How did that begin? Not agency-wise, but in job-wise. What kinds of stuff were you doing?
Oh, man.
All sorts of monster things or
– Yeah. Well, it started – I guess a couple years after we last worked together. I think I was the WB Frog for like 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then
The frog that did the logo frog that would come up to announce
for like a couple of weeks. And I think Mo LaMarche ended up doing it after me and stuff. And it really started happening with it. Animation is where it really started popping up. I mean, there were some commercials and voiceovers and radios and stuff like that. Fannie Mae. I was the voice of Walmart.
You were doing commercial when you come into Walmart. For super low prices.
Well, no. I was the. It was like a Louis Armstrong-esque sound. I was like,
really?
Yeah, it was like always low prices, always Walmart. That was me, smiley face, and they did a bunch of spots, and I rep them for a few years, and then Fannie Mae, and then it just kind of went all over the place, and Southwest and.
So like so many people, which I haven't been able to do very well, but you were sort of chameleon-like in your vocal qualities.
Yes. Yeah.
So if they asked for a certain thing, which is really good if you're doing voiceovers, you could be very flexible in your sound.
It helps. It helps because, sometimes you don't want to just do just you, and it is cool. It's cool to do your thing. Sometimes you get an idea and say, what if we try it this way or this kind of character and stuff? Because originally, I remember that Walmart ad, they wanted the straightforward, always low prices, always Walmart, that kind of thing. And I said, what if we gave him something like a Louis, like something like that? And I remember it was here in this office I auditioned. I remember Ben, who was the agent at the time, was like, nah, you don't want to do it. I said, well, just try it. Just send it. And sure enough, man. They called and they said that's what they wanted.
Really?
Yeah. So sometimes you got to just go outside the bubble there. You know what I mean? Because you really have no idea. Because a lot of the times they don't know what the hell they want.
Right.
You know? And, if you're having fun behind the mic, I find the listener has fun listening. That's really the key.
Did you always have the ability to be so so flexible in your voice, and did that come from being a little kid and doing all these shows, or when the business of voiceover started happening for you, you thought, I'm going to have to develop a skill set around making different sounds, different voices, different impressions, different things?
Yeah, I think it was just really, oh gosh. I don't know.
You just got it, man.
I just
you just got it. Like, it's all right to Kevin, admit that, Kevin. Talk? No. It's all right. No, it's all right to say, Tom, it just happens, no, man. I open my mouth and it's gold. Get over it.
I'm not going to say that. But
what? It's that showbiz. No, that's what I would do if I were you.
I had a lot of luck. A lot of luck and a lot of prayer. You know what I mean? Because it was something when I first heard about the, you know, in the business, I said, wow. I mean, I would love to do that. The animation, the cartoon. I said, God, I would love to do that. You know, so it's really a dream come true, like a blessing and a lot of luck. And just really, it's kind of a wish come true for me, really.
Yeah. You know, and what so. Were – just so people would, you know what were some of the big roles you've done in animation?
Well – Whew. Oh boy!
I mean, because you've done a million, so you don't have to give us the whole IMDb.
I was a Captain Gantu in Lilo and Stitch.
Uh-huh.
I was the Joker for the Batman, the voice of the Joker for the Batman. After Mark Hamill.
Yeah, after because Mark was great.
Yo,
so Mark
was fantastic.
Mark was really
he's fantastic.
People and I've had Mark on the podcast.
Oh, he's fantastic.
And I don't think people really understand Mark Hamill's talent.
He's amazing.
And in like character in creating a character vocally and doing that stuff. Mm-hmm. His Joker was spectacular.
Yeah, and I worked with him time and time again. And when I moved out here, you know, you had to work a lot of jobs because things didn't really start getting off the ball right away. I was a security guard at a strip club in the Valley, Star Garden. And I remember back in 92 and I would race to work. They had a television over the bar. So while I'm watching, you know, the place to make sure everything's safe, you know, of course you couldn't hear the volume, but they would show the Batman.
Sure.
And I would just watch it in awe. And whenever I got home of that, if I wasn't working and I heard Mark, I was like, wow, this guy's fantastic.
So,
not knowing, of course, it was Mark Hamill until they showed behind the scenes.
So the great big black dude with the big voice who was the bouncer at the strip club is looking over their heads and going, wow, look, everybody, it's Batman.
Yeah, well, all these topless girls are dancing on stage. I'm watching
Would
Batman.
You tell me, I mean, what in the world is it like to be the bouncer at a strip club?
Exciting for like a few days and then completely boring after that. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like, you know.
I guess I don't even mean like, hey, you get to see naked girls. I mean like just the clientele, man.
It was
sad.
It was
that's
really
what I mean.
Sad, man.
That's
it
what I mean. I mean, that's what you're dealing with. People would think that you're dealing with 6'7" dudes going, I want to see naked chicks.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
But really, I would imagine that you're just seeing kind of the dregs.
A lot of bikers, you know, and some cool guys along the way, but – it was sad to see the folks who came in who actually thought they had a chance with some of these ladies that were taking them for, you know, for the dough. But
wait a minute, you don't?
Yeah. It is, you know, they were nice and stuff. But I was making next to nothing. I was making horrible money at the time. It was horrible. It was a horrible paying gig, too. But
and what, that was a night job till 2 or 3 o'clock
in
the morning?
Yeah, like, exactly. I was like 6 till 1:30 or something like that. It was just a horrible paying gig, man. And God, I was lucky if I got it at that time, honestly, $40 a night. It was really bad. But it was like I was looking for any little quick, you know, thing to make, you know, pay bills and stuff.
But for a while you were engaged to 6 girls at a time.
No.
Which was, you know.
Yeah, right. But it was so bad that I would actually sneak off to church on Sundays. Like, Kevin, what are you going to do if you break? You have to take a break. And they ended up making me manager of the place on Sundays. I would take my break and go to church at St. Charles and come back after church.
St. Charles right over here, right in North
in
Hollywood,
Valley,
right?
Exactly,
yeah, North Hollywood.
Right, and I would come right back to work. I mean, because I just – you know, I just wanted some peace, man. It's
what were you
crazy,
doing? Yeah,
man.
When you – no, it doesn't sound crazy. I mean, it sounds natural. Like what – what – it's none of my business, but what's coming out of your heart there when you're going – like are you just going like, yeah, I know, God, but man, I need the $40 or like I don't know what's going on.
There's
man.
Work at the post office, Kevin. You know, it was like
I don't think he might talk like that. Yeah. He might just say, Kevin, really? Yeah. Seriously? Seriously, man? You can't afford $40. You can't really
like Pokemania.
Really?
No, it was.
Do you think these girls? I mean,
it was only.
Come on.
And I think I only did it for like 6-5 months or something.
Oh,
like
really?
That. Yeah, and that was it because work's kind
you
of.
You mean
stuck.
The going to church thing? So
no,
you just said forget it.
No, working at the club because that's when things started getting fun. And I think I was fired actually. I don't remember why. Maybe because I wasn't showing up. I got tired of showing up.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'm glad because, you know, I was able to excel in what I really wanted to do. Because I remember even then I was starting to get gigs and stuff. While I was doing that job, I got Fatal Instinct. with Armand Asante and like Sean Young. It was a spoof off Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct. I was the bailiff in that, Bailiff Franklin, you know, and I was, then things started to happen. But it was going to church, man. It was just like, I just needed some kind of like something to get away from it, something far, far away from that gig. And that was my
just mind. Sort of a yin yang sort of
right.
thing. I just need to go and kind of get some balance on the
right.
ship.
That was my ingredients of peace. That
before
was
I go back to the tornado.
Right. That was my large ingredient of peace at the time, which I really needed and really helped me. And, you know, so I'm not a Bible thumper, you know, or like, you know, Christ freak, but, you know, just a man of faith. And it was just something, you know, I needed to do to escape from some pretty serious stuff there, man. You know, I saw some, you know, I saw some not nice things there, you know. It was just, you know, our ability to survive is actually a phenomenal thing. You know, you have to do certain jobs until you actually come out of the mud, you know. And that was part of the road for me.
Well, I'm glad you came out of the mud.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, I think you were right in just saying, I don't know, whenever I've been, because I've worked in nightclubs since I was 19. I mean, yeah. I've been working stand up and everything
and all kinds of dives and
places
since
you know, a couple of years before I was even legal to be inside the place.
Wow. Back when rules weren't as strict.
Right.
Yeah, right.
But
nowadays.
You know, as everyone, hey, there are a lot of colorful, flashy lights.
Yeah, yeah.
But man, inside there, you scratch the surface, that's a pretty sad thing.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah. And to see the same people every day, it was just, oof. It was gnarly. It was pretty gnarly. I mean, there were some really cool folks, some sweet folks. There were some folks I would see at church that would be in there. They would see me and they'd like have this look of shock, you know, but... You know, that's just the way it was.
Yeah. So what are a couple of other – I won't bother you too long today, but what a couple of other you know, voiceover things? Are you still doing announcer things?
Well, character stuff, like the voice of Spam. I'm the voice of Sir Canalot. You know, he's like dressed as a knight. He's like, excuse me, madam. You know, try glorious Spam. That's me, basically.
You're on a Spam commercial.
Yeah, Spam and Liquid Plumber, which is the new ad, which is kind of – you can't believe that they've done it. I thought I was being punked when they asked me to actually record. I said, wait a minute. You want me to read this? Because it's really blue if you heard it. Liquid Plumber has a long, deep snake to go deep into your pipe. You know, it's like, what?
But, is that radio?
Yeah, no, it's
a TV commercial.
It's TV, man, and it's out there nationally. It's blue, but it's selling, and they're happy. And I had fun doing it, but I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? We're really doing this? But
man, I thought that my charm when I was auditioning for toilet paper, and it was a bear just in the woods going, enjoy the go.
Is that you?
No, that's not me. No, I didn't get it. I didn't get it, darn it, and thank God.
Oh,
but
man.
It should have been me.
Yeah, you're damn right, Tom Wilson. Everybody, hire this man. He's awesome.
Yeah, I was going to the callbacks for it. You know, I kept going up and up and up, and it's for a bear. It's a bear going in the woods, and you know, and you're feeling like, oh brother, are you kidding me? And the lady, I'm at the final audition, and the lady saying, you know, just so you know, I mean, the last guy that had a gig like this for this company, I mean, he bought a house just with the residuals.
Okay, no pressure. But then,
didn't end up being a bear.
That's just the next gig waiting for you.
So what is in the future for Kevin? What kind of things? What goals do you have? What are you going after?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, man, I've been on the fence with On Camera for a long time. You know, whether I'm going to be going back to it or not, because this has picked up so much, and that's a good thing. But On Camera has always been kind of itching at me, whether I'm going to go back to it or not. So that's really – I've been at that fork of the road for a while.
On Camera, what has come your way as clearly – a very large and powerful black man with a big voice.
Yeah.
I would think just for me, it's like the pickings are relatively slim because of all those things, because of their lead actor is going to be 5'8".
Right.
All of those things.
Yeah. And through the years of the past couple decades, though, I've noticed it's gotten wider. And, you know, it's gotten, you know, I wouldn't say mega plentiful, but definitely a lot more than it used to be.
Yeah.
And
that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. So – Oh, man. I mean, the first season of ER, I played Patrick. Mm-hmm. He was the mentally challenged kid with a football helmet uh-huh. and run around the hospital. And
yeah.
Then my first big gig was Homeboys in Outer Space, which was a UPN show. And
you were in the Homeboys in Outer Space. Yeah. Wow.
We caught a lot of flack for that
you
one,
see
man.
Everybody?
Spike Lee did not – he wasn't too happy, but
– Showbiz is just a stairway to the stars, but, man. Homeboys in Outer Space.
Even reading the title before the audition, I think I cried. Like I said, is this what my life has come to? But I got the gig and enjoyed it. Rolling Stone ending up loving us and stuff. Yeah. And you know,
well, there are auditions that you – as you know, there are auditions that you get to. I've been to auditions, and I'll know an actress who's waiting in the room and everything. Yeah, and we all have our sides, our little material, and she just leans over to me. Oh, God, I hope I don't get this. Did you read this?
Don't put the gun in your mouth. Yes, don't put the gun in your mouth.
I mean, we all have to be here. My agent will be angry if I don't go. I hope I don't get this.
And then boom. Yeah, Clancy Brown, good buddy.
Sure, I know.
Said
Clancy,
that, you know, yeah. He goes, you want to make an actor upset? Give him a job.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. And I was happy getting those gigs, man. I mean, I had fun doing that guest spots, you know, Mad About You, How I Met Your Mother. I've been happy doing a lot of those gigs. I mean, I do miss it. The process is. I mean, it's a lot more exertion compared to voiceover. I mean, of course, sometimes depending on who you work with, the voiceover, because some people will have you scream till your throat is bleeding.
That happens to me a lot.
With monsters.
Not literally bleeding, but with monsters, with the big guys, I find.
Yeah, yeah.
They hire me or you or the big guy with a big low voice.
Right,
and they just
great.
Go, and you just scream.
Yeah.
And you scream, and then
holy
they go,
holy Moses, man.
Hey, Tom, could we bring it up like 50%
yeah.
and like
yeah.
do it lower and everything?
Yeah.
And you just really.
And louder,
yeah.
meaner.
And you're just thinking, I am going to lose my voice from this.
And that's happened.
And it certainly and happens.
Happened.
It happens
that's
a lot.
Happened. Yeah.
But you
yeah,
think,
yeah.
I'm just doing it for the money today, and we'll just figure out about that audition tomorrow when tomorrow comes.
Right,
but
right.
for right now, I'm in the job, so I got to do it.
yeah. yeah, okay. We're looking for Tom Wilson. I'm right here. You got that little voice apparatus because your voice is shot.
Yeah.
You know, Goro, Mortal Kombat, the movie, I was the voice of Goro. He was a creature who had literally four arms. He had six limbs, four arms, two legs. And I was excited about that job, and then, you know, I forgot what was the guy's name, Lawrence Kasdanoff or something, was directing me, and dude, I was screamed my ass off. My voice was gone by the first day. I was like, oh my God. I realized I was shredding my voice. Who knows what I've done to myself, but that was like a throat ripper, man.
Yeah.
So, and to see our friends do this, you know, like Fred Tatasciore Shore and some of these other guys out there, Frank Welker, God bless him. You know, these guys, who's a legend. Frank's an absolute legend in doing these creatures and stuff. I think he's cut down on them, but after a while, you know, after 15, 20 minutes, half hour of doing this over and over and then going up to 2-3 hours, you watch him, you go,
oh, it really blows you out. Yeah.
It's painful.
So being the prominent voiceover talent that you are, and go.
Who needs therapy, everybody? Just call Tom Wilson. That's 555-2121.
But you're moving back into on camera more when you can. So what are you doing other arts in your life? Do you do other things?
I love to sing when I can.
Uh-huh.
I love to sing. I've been asked to sing in a few things by some folks, which is very cool, but in my spare time, the missus and I love to go out to karaoke to the little private rooms and just rent these little private rooms and sing karaoke.
You're the karaoke king?
Yeah. Well,
so you rent the private room just you and your wife?
Yeah, or friends.
Or a couple friends.
Saltel and Olympic Max Karaoke, you just rent these rooms and you have a blast, man. And one buddy of mine, Roger Rose and Jim Cummings, you know Jim Cummings.
Uh-huh.
And they said, Jim's like, we're going to bring a friend of ours, okay? And I'm like, who? And they come in with Kenny G. So literally Kenny G is singing with us in this small little rinky-dink karaoke room. And we're like, what the hell? It was wild, man. It was like you could have a blast at these places, man.
He didn't bring a soprano sax along with some?
No. He wrote a sweet
What is your big song?
I do a little bit of everything. I do – oh, man. I do Barry White, Can't Get Enough of Your Love, Babe, Tom Jones, Delilah, Feed Me, you name it. We do everything.
I've only done it a couple of times. I haven't done karaoke very much. I think I've done it twice.
It's
but
blast.
Both times, you know my showstopper?
No.
Copacabana. Barry Manilow. Her name was Lola. She was a showgirl, but that was 30 years ago when she used to have a show.
But it still works.
Now it's a disco, but not for Lola. You know, yeah, exactly. It's a lot of fun. I'm telling you, it's a showstopper. Standing up both times. So
you're going to be opening for Barry next time he plays, right?
I only hope. Yeah. Right. Yep. So when hopeful people come, because as you know, there are so many in voiceover, and everyone will come to you and say, "You're Kevin Michael Richardson. Listen to this.
Hey, guys. Yeah. I do a voice like this.
Can you take me to your agent? Where is it? Can we drive there now?"
That happens every once in a while, man.
What do you tell people that want into this business in any capacity, really?
I say, you know, well, have you done any theater? Have you done any shows? Have you taken any acting classes? You know, because all of that, like, you know, fits into the bill. I mean, that all has something to do with what you can actually do. Or do you want to just go straight for it and do it? I recommend them to, like, if they really have the chops and they have a serious reel, and sometimes they'll pass it on to me and I don't know them, and I'll take a listen and then I'll say, oh, wow, this guy's really good. I might, you know, pass it along. But there's a lot of folks that do it that really just want to get into it and have – they're very green, you know, like, you know, when we just started, you know. Mm-hmm.
But I think you had the capacity, though, to break down a script in the way that you would do it like a play.
Right.
Which is important.
Which comes from training, right? Which comes from theater or getting involved in plays.
Exactly.
Like that, which
it's
really
not
helps.
Just like, oh, I'm going to take the first line of this and do a funny voice
for it.
It's like seeing what the character is, what the arc of this scene is, where I need to get to,
exactly.
And all of
what's
those
the through
things.
Line? What is mm-hmm. it? Exactly. Though that takes place into what you need to do. And it's kind of hard because you don't want to really – some people, you know, especially if they're really kind – you know, you want to break it to them, you know, nicely, gently. But nowadays, I just basically tell them, look, if you really want to get into this, I kind of just steer them toward people they can talk to take courses with that you and I work with as casting directors mm-hmm. and who are maybe still teaching. Like Jenny McSwain, he was teaching a course, Andre Romano and stuff like that. And I'd say, if you really want to do this, I highly recommend you take their course. So you can get an idea, you know, of how to work this, you know, how to start, you know, because, you know, you don't want to go in completely not knowing anything, you know.
And you are kind to them, as I try to be. I mean, I'm not as successful as you are in voiceover, certainly, but I try to be kind to them. But in the same way, also, I mean – CeCe Sabathia is probably kind to the person who wants to be a pitcher. But you're already saying, I'm not sure that you understand the work that's involved
exactly.
in getting to the place that you think you should be today.
I think
it's going to be a while.
Certainly
it's worthwhile.
Right.
But yeah, I think you have to start way back here.
Yeah, man.
And then come on.
Right. And some people are willing to do that. Some people are like, okay, what do I do? And they're willing to do that. And then there's some that are not. They want it, you know, right now. And, you know, you really have – it's perseverance and patience and faith.
I think there are aspects of show business that we all hate, and that certainly I admit it. I can be the curmudgeon, the, you know, I've had it with this business or whatever more than on a few occasions.
Yeah.
But I think, as you know, I don't know anyone, I think, who hasn't come here and worked really hard where something hasn't happened. You know, just something.
Right.
That kid who says, I want in and I'll do – you know, whatever it takes, in working hard being an assistant on a set or whatever.
Yeah, they work till the payoff and they don't care how long, they just bust their chops.
I mean,
and do
I couldn't believe it. I was on a Civil War movie years ago, and these kids would show up a couple, you know, early in the movie, and they're young, you know, they're young guys, and they just want to be stunts or something. And they're there every morning, you know. If you wanted anybody to throw me over a building or kill me, I could kill, you know. And there's a big crowd of them. And you know, the stunt coordinator, well, kid, that's not really how it goes or whatever. But as the movie goes on, of course, this crowd of kids gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And a few of them kept coming and coming and coming and coming. And honest to goodness, late in the show – The stunt coordinator goes to these guys. He says, all right, you, do you want Tom over here? You know, point him, do you want him? I mean, he's going to lift you up and throw you over a tent and you land in some dirt. Yes, I'll do it. You know, that night, they were there all – because it was a night shoot. We were there all night long until the next morning at 7 o'clock. And this kid that had been there every day begging for the work. I mean, he got his union card, and I lifted him up by the belt, and I threw him as far as I could throw him.
You know? And he liked it.
And he loved it.
He's in a wheelchair now, but he loved it.
I'm going up to him. Are you okay? You know, are you okay, Timmy? Drop leg. Throw me farther. I'm in a movie. You know. So
what movie?
It's called Andersonville. About the Andersonville prison.
I have to watch that now because that's all I'm going to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's been this gigantic fight. You know, this big fight scene comes up.
And you chuck him over it. Wow.
He goes, okay, guys, come on in. Yeah, yeah. Come on in. You'll get paid for tonight. It's going to be a long night.
Might die.
It's going to be tedious, and we're going to throw you around, but come on in.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, thanks so much, Kevin. I appreciate your time,
man,
here at the CESD Agency Studios Los Angeles, California.
Thank you. Thank you. And what a pleasure it is sitting here with you. You know, I was always have been a big fan of yours. Always, always. I mean, we're talking since Back to the Future to Action Jackson, for God's sake.
You're a fan of Action Jackson.
Yes, I am.
Wow.
Yes, I am.
Carl Weathers is
that's the man.
Action Jackson.
He was the man. He's still around, too. Carl's still kicking. You know, he was on an episode of $6 Million Man, for God's sake.
Oh, Carl's great.
I had no idea.
Carl's great.
Yeah.
He was a great guy. It was a fun movie to do just in stunts because it was so – I mean, Action Jackson, they were doing stunts every day. They were blowing stuff up, crashing cars.
Guys
were jumping between buildings. And I was just sitting in a director chair, you know.
That's one dead piece of shit car building. Is that what you said?
You remember the movie.
That's one dead piece of shit car building. I remember you said something like that.
Yeah. I actually improvised that and kept it in the movie. Because I didn't have enough lines in the thing.
You were great.
Weathers and Craig T. Nelson kept getting me in trouble.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Why?
So the director, because they would make it look like I did a practical joke on somebody or whatever. I had this small part of the movie. So Carl and Craig T. Nelson go, Tom, would you stop? We're trying to work here. I didn't do it. I didn't do it.
I believe that. I had two buddies in there, Stan Foster and Miguel Nunez. So
Stan.
Those were the producers. Those are the co-exec producers of Homeboys in Outer
Space.
Are
you kidding me?
No, that's how I met them.
Stan Foster. That was one of his first jobs, I think, Stan. Stan, we had myself and Peter. Peter's last name. But Peter was my cop partner. We were downtown Los Angeles. And there were a lot of people waiting for a bus. Like, it was a crowded downtown street where it's such a big crowd because it's a rush hour that, you know, it's like half the crowd's going to get onto the bus, half the crowd's going to have to wait for the next bus. A huge crowd. So we are in absolutely the cherry, the lights on top and everything, Detroit Police Department car, in Detroit Police Department uniforms and everything. Stan Foster is the young perp in the back. Okay, so it's a huge break in the filming, and we say, Stan, run across the street, and we're going to turn on all the lights and everything, and we're going to turn on – we're going to turn on the siren, and you run, and I'm going to pull it right up in front of that crowd of people, and we're going to arrest you. You know, we'll tackle you onto the ground and everything, arrest you. I've got the fake handcuffs and everything. So we do it. Because the street was closed. So Stan runs across the street. I turn, the lights and everything. We're racing him. He's running in front of the car. So finally, we pull around in front of these people at the bus stop. We get out of the car, tackle Stan, handcuff him, put him over the top of the car. And people are like, way to go, officer. Way to go.
Detroit.
You guys are from Detroit? You're from Detroit? We almost lost him in Colorado. Man, I'll tell you, this kid can run. So we put him in the back of the car and drove away.
That's brilliant.
Anyway, that's my Stan Foster.
If I bump into him, man, I gotta
Action
say
Jackson
that.
Story. But yeah, Stan was great.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
But thank you very much,
Tommy.
Kevin. I appreciate your time, buddy.
Tommy, man. Thanks, man.
I
hope you enjoyed my conversation. See, I can't. I can sort of. I can make my attempts at having a voice like that. But really, see, when you hear Kevin's voice, you go, oh, that's. Boy, those are some resonators there he's got in his chest. Anyway, thanks so much. I enjoyed talking with Kevin. Kevin is one of the great guys in town, and it's always nice to see him and talk to him. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out on the live show. And in the intro, I went to pick up my guitar. Thanks to Chris Camp in Escondido, California, for doing such magnificent guitar repair. But thank you for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Telling a friend about the podcast. We'll keep making them. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.